This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices Hot Topics, episode number 6, was recorded on March 2nd, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. The COVID-19 global pandemic has finally hit the public consciousness, but public awareness is still very low. The President of the United States assured the American people that COVID-19 has a much lower case fatality rate than the seasonal flu. Now, in point of fact, the present consensus estimate of 2% case fatality rate for COVID-19 is actually 28 times more deadly than the seasonal flu's case fatality rate of 0.07%. I interviewed Dr. Chris Martinson way back on January 30th, more than a month ago, and frankly, all of that interview is as relevant today as the day it was recorded. So we're re-airing that interview today in order to provide that information to what will hopefully be a broader audience. Quite a lot has changed since January 30th, so I'll be back after the interview ends to give you the March 2nd update on what's changed since the interview you're about to hear was originally recorded on January 30th. This interview was recorded before the World Health Organization had declared an international emergency and before they had assigned the name COVID-19 to this disease. So you'll hear us referring to the disease as NCOV or NCOV. When you hear Dr. Martinson explain the meaning of R0, the transmissivity index for a virus, he will describe how many people can ultimately be infected after 10 hops or successive transmissions of the virus. Dr. Martinson misspoke when he said 10 hops. He was actually citing accurate data for 20 hops, not 10 hops. So please forgive that small mistake. There's also quite a bit of new research showing R0 for COVID-19 is even higher than we knew during this interview. I'll give you an update on that and several other topics after the interview. But right now, let's go ahead and listen to that January 30th interview. Joining us now is Dr. Chris Martinson, who holds a PhD in pathology with a specialty in toxicology from Duke University, and is also the founder and CEO of PeakProsperity.com. Chris, thanks so much for joining us. We've got a lot to talk about, so let's dive right in. I personally hold a very out-of-consensus view, and frankly, my greatest hope is that you're going to tell me that I have it all wrong and things are not as bad as I think. Most people that I encounter on financial Twitter keep telling me, look, there have been no deaths outside of China. This thing is nothing more than a glorified seasonal flu. So, Eric, stop being an alarmist. Stop acting like this thing is going to be another SARS. That's crazy. It's irresponsible. Don't say that. Chris, quite frankly, based on what I've seen, I think it would be a godsend if this turned out to only be as bad as SARS. And that's definitely not consensus view. I fear that it's going to be worse, but I don't hold a PhD in this field, and you do. So let's start with the big picture. What's your view of the situation? Based on what we know so far, is this thing likely to be more bad or less bad than the 2003 SARS epidemic? And let's just say overall on a scale, if you said that a bad seasonal flu season was the good end of the scale and a repeat of the 1918 Spanish flu, which killed more than 50 million people, would be the extreme bad end of the scale, which end of the scale are we on and where is this thing headed?
Well, Eric, first, thanks for having me on, and I wish it was under different circumstances. This viral pandemic really has me pretty worried, and there's just a number of things that I know we'll get into that sort of define that. And this is where everybody, including your listeners especially, of course, need to be aware of the details of this. Listen, none of us wanted to become viral epidemiologists. None of us wanted to know things like R0, which I know we're getting to in various terms, but by the numbers, this is everything we've been expecting and worrying about and fearing would come as a pandemic. And it's kind of like right out of central casting, you know, it's from the movie Contagion. This is a virus, a coronavirus, which is an RNA virus, which has its lineage as coming from a bat, passing through a snake, picking up some mysterious middle zone, which seems to confer the ability to attach to human tissue, jumped into humans, And then it's doing human-to-human transmissions. And it's got some pretty bad statistics coming out of China, but I don't trust those. You know, I think they're probably close to accurate in terms of their overall percentages and ratios. So the total infected, total serious complications, death rate, those ratios might be close to right, but the total numbers, I'm sure, are being lowballed by China because, you know, that's politically what they want to do. And I don't know anybody who really trusts those numbers. So with that caveat, the numbers we're seeing are showing this to be on a perfectly exponential growth curve right now, which is what you would expect for a cross-species jumping virus where there's no herd immunity whatsoever. It's coming into a completely fertile field to expand within, and it's doing that. So yes, this has me very concerned. Where is it on the spectrum? Well, if our health authorities really drop the ball, yes, this could be as bad as the Spanish flu, and maybe worse, because there's a couple of statistics we can get to later that are far more virulent and possibly pathogenic than the 1918 flu was. And again, a little caution, we didn't have the best data gathering back then, but comparing what we know, this has all the hallmarks of being on that end of the scale, not on the flu end of the scale.
Okay. As you said, there's quite a few important concepts that we need to get to for our listeners. So let's start with something called asymptomatic transmission. What does that phrase mean? And more importantly, why is it so important to understand its implications on the authorities' ability to contain the outbreak using the same technique that they were able to use in order to contain the SARS outbreak?
Well, sure. Let's just break that word right down. Asymptomatic has its root as symptoms. So what's a symptom of flu? Well, fever, chills, you've got aches and pains, running nose, things like that, coughing. So asymptomatic is just putting the word A in front of that, meaning no, so no symptoms. So asymptomatic means we haven't got any symptoms. We feel perfectly healthy. We look normal. A doctor could take all sorts of measurements and say, can't tell that you're not just a uninfected normal person. And then transmission means the ability to transmit this virus. There's lots of data now that there is this asymptomatic transmission. Individuals with no outward expression of symptoms have the virus, are replicating the virus, are shedding the virus, and that's a big, big problem for containment because if you can't detect these people, but they're out there spreading the disease, it makes it very difficult to contain. And this was, of course, one of my earliest complaints that I put out there. January 24th was the first day I put out an alert to everybody who follows me. And I said, hey, not only is this seemingly to be a pretty bad virus in the scheme of things, not only should we be taking it very seriously, but these efforts, air quotes around that word, at the airport, where you have the people holding up the little, you know, fever detector that they point at your forehead, the temperature reader, are totally ineffective if you've got asymptomatic transmission, because you're only going to detect people who have a fever, which is fine, but it's not nearly enough. And the key with something like this, you talk to any epidemiologist, any virologist, the key to stopping a pandemic like this is you have to contain it. And if that means a full citywide quarantine that nobody can escape, that's great. But allowing planes with people whose condition you don't know to jet all over the world is actually not the right way to go about this if you have asymptomatic transmission. Again, I don't have direct confirmation of that, but I have reports out of China saying that that's the case here, especially among children. There's a number of cases of young children, 10 and under, who have the disease, who test positive for the disease, who are expressing no symptoms. And so that's quite a worry.
Okay, Chris, let's talk now about a number that epidemiologists call R0 or R0. What does that mean? Why is it so important? And how does the R0 value for NCOV, the new virus, compare with something like SARS or other well-known diseases, such as, let's say, the regular seasonal flu?
This is a little bit of a technical concept, but super important, one that's well worth grasping, not only for this particular incident, but to understand it in general. It's handy during any flu season. So R0 or R0 is just a measure that asks and tries to answer this question. For an average person who's infected with that particular virus, how many other people are they going to pass it to while they're in their communicative stage of this or transmissive stage? So an R0 of 1 would mean, gosh, I have a chance of passing it on to one other person. And R0 of 1 is sufficient for something to stay resident within a population. It just keeps passing from person to person, and it lives, but it doesn't really explode. It just kind of stays there. An R-naught of less than zero, say I have a 0.5 chance of passing it to somebody else, those will actually self-limit and die out over time. So perhaps your listeners have heard of like these mystery diseases that sort of emerge and then go away again. Many of those have low R-naughts or less than one R-naughts can be an explanation for why that happens sometimes. But things start to get a little tricky when you get over one. So let's take a normal flu season. A lot of people have said, and I heard you say it at the intro, hey, flu kills 8,000 people a year. This is no worse than the flu. In fact, it's only killed a fraction of the people that flu takes out in the United States. That's a United States figure alone, right? And they've got a point, but the R-naught of flu, seasonal flu, is 1.28, which means that let's take this through 10 hops. So, and what I mean by that is I've got the flu. I pass it to 1.28 people on average. Those 1.28 people pass it to another 1.28 people on average. And these 10 hops, let's make it easy. These hops happen in a day. I become infective in a day. In 10 days time, with an R-naught of 1.28, there would now be 139 people out there infected with this disease compared to my original one. And if those hops take 3 days, that's a 30-day window. And if they take 7 days, you know, just keep multiplying. But we're just trying to catch the number of hops. I hope I'm making that clear. Well, now let's jump up to, say, an R-naught of 2. And it's thought that the Spanish flu had an R-naught of 1.8. So it was slightly less than these numbers, but I'm just taking whole numbers. So hopefully makes it easy. That means that two people get infected from me, and then those two infect 4, and then 8, 16, 32, 64, and it jumps like that. After 10 hops with an R-naught of 2, we've now seen an infection of 1,048,576 people. Let's call that 1.05 million people, compared to 139 when we had an R-naught of 1.28. So that's what happens when you go from 1.28 to 2. Now what happens when we go to 2.5, which is the low end of the R-naught scale estimate for this nCoV virus? And again, these numbers could all change, and I'm really worried we have bad data out of China. This could be too high, could be too low. We don't know, but right now it's the best number we've got. An R-naught of 2.5, you take that through those same 10 hops we've been talking about, and that infects 91 million people. So this is why the R-naught matters a lot. It's an exceedingly sensitive number. If it went to 3, that would become 3.4 billion people. So that just really tells us, the R-naught doesn't tell us that 3.4 billion people would get infected, but it tells us how infective this is. And it begins to help us understand, you know, when we were looking at China, it's like, oh, there's, you know, 1,000 cases, less than 50 deaths. And next thing you know, they're shutting down Beijing and Shanghai and really going quite serious in their efforts. This begins to explain why, because this is a very, very infective disease.
Okay, so it's too early to know exactly what the value of R-naught is going to be. But what we do in finance and what you do in science is the same thing. If you can't predict something, you start looking for a proxy that will give you a sense of it. Now, I know you have been watching, as have I, the almost perfectly exponential growth rate of the case count coming out of China. Now, a lot of people are really on my case on Twitter saying, why the hell are you trusting Chinese statistics? And the answer is, I'm not. But if anything, China's underreporting this. I don't think that it's actually better, and China's telling us it's worse than it really is. So if I just go by the statistics that the Chinese government is giving me, to me, it seems like we're on a perfectly exponential growth path. What do you make of these data, and what does it tell you about the contagiousness of this nCoV virus, and how does that relate to the R-naught concept?
Well, first, we need to understand that, yes, these are lowball numbers. These are going to be the rock bottom. And there's a number of reasons for why we would not trust the Chinese data, even beyond we don't trust the Chinese government to tell us the truth. The simple truth is they didn't have the ability to test properly for this early on. It's a very sensitive test. It's a polymerase chain reaction test kits. You know, it takes time to assemble them. It takes time to process them. Labs have only so much capacity. If this thing is an order of magnitude more prevalent than we think it is, the cases reported could simply be as something where that's as many as they could detect, because that's how many kits they had. And I know they're ramping up kits, but their most recent statement was they're going to be able to do 2,000 kits a day Well, that doesn't help you when you're getting 4,000 new infections a day when you get to that part of the curve. And we're pretty close to that at this point, based on the data we have. So that's part one. Part two, it's really important to note the trajectory of these things, and it maps into the infectivity or the transmissiveness of this. So when we look at SARS, it was first started getting tracked in March of 2003, and there were a few cases then, and that's when it sort of blossomed into awareness. But when they did the forensics on it, and they went back and they said, geez, how far back, where did this start? Because that's always the question you want to answer and ask in this particular question. Where did it start? And that tells you a lot about how it spread and what the mechanisms were. There's a lot of information in that particular piece of information. Well, the farthest back they can trace SARS was in November 2002. So from November to December, January, February, April, May, you know, all the way on out, it took months for it to even burst onto the scene. Now, our first reports were that December 8th is the first known case. I think they're trying to back that up into maybe October or November. It's still a little murky where this thing started and when it started. But even with that, let's back it all the way up to it's October somewhere. Somehow this thing got out into the public. The early data says that the pace of the spreading of this and the case count and the death count vastly exceed anything that we've seen in SARS, vastly exceeds anything we see in swine flu and every other sort of pandemic that's come along that we've been worried about lately, MERS, all of that. This thing is spreading a lot more easily, and it's actually blowing the doors off of any other disease that we've sort of had out there. And the press has done a magnificently, terribly, horribly bad job of trying to compare this to SARS to say, look, it's not that bad. When they're comparing apples and oranges statistically, and they don't understand that this is a time series data, not one where you get any information from just looking at total numbers. Well, SARS had 8,000 cases. We only have 6,000. Totally irrelevant. On the basis of the timing of this and how fast it came out and the nature of its perfectly exponential curve right now, which again might be based on lowballed data, tells us this is something that's worthy of our strongest respect. I'm not asking people to be afraid and panic and do all that stuff, but I am saying, oh, this is something that deserves your attention, and people should decide that for themselves and not rely on whatever it is the World Health Organization or CNN is saying. Those organizations are always going to be a day late and a dollar short on a story like this.
Okay, so we don't know what the real numbers are going to be, but the data that we do have available to us is suggesting that this is more contagious than SARS or common flu or MERS or any of these other things, swine flu and what have you. Meanwhile, unlike SARS, where they knew how to contain it, which is they take your temperature because you get the temperature or fever before you become contagious, then all they have to do is quarantine you, test you for it. There's a pretty straightforward process there. It doesn't work here because of asymptomatic transmission. Now, a lot of people, despite all this, are saying, look, okay, we get it. China is clearly in a crisis, but there hasn't been a single death outside of China thus far. I think that's actually not true anymore. There was one in Thailand. But they're just saying, look, okay, so don't go to China. But aside from that, stop worrying. This thing is only affecting China. Chris, is that logic sound in your opinion? And if not, specifically, why not?
Well, you know, I just did a podcast the other day with John Barry, and he literally wrote the book on the Spanish flu. And he's really just a world expert on this and has served on a bunch of panels under various presidents around virus infectious diseases. So when we look at what's really happening here and how it's spreading, I like to think of it, you know, those brush fires that we've seen in Australia and where there's that main contagion, that main fire is burning. That's China. What you have to watch out for are the sparks that are heading outside. And firefighters can get in there. And when there's just a few embers sort of flying forward from the main fire area, you can knock those down. That's what's happening right now. I mean, last count yesterday, there was 18 countries that had detected this. I'm sure it's higher now. You know, we had a really worrying case in Japan where their second case was a bus driver who caught it earlier this month. And we don't know what that means. Was that 4 weeks ago, three? We don't know. From a group of tourists from Wuhan and then eventually had symptoms and presented. Now, that's worrying because it's a bus driver, right? And somehow he caught it from somebody on one of his buses. We're going to assume that they weren't being physical and chummy and things like that, because I don't think that's how those two cultures interact. So this was airborne. And then if he had an asymptomatic transmission phase as a bus driver, there's no way you're going to track down everybody who was on every bus that this gentleman drove. So that's where it becomes worrying. And then those sparks that are flying around out there, eventually there's a spark you don't catch. There's a spark that catches fire. And by the time you get in there, you know, you find that you're fighting a second fire in a second country. That's the thing we've been waiting for. I think that's just a matter of time. And again, we're going to have to defer here to something called the law of big numbers. When this thing was first erupting up through about, the 20s of January, so like the 19th through the 25th or something, there were still, I think, a relative handful of cases, even if it was 10 times more than China was admitting to. That's a relative handful. When now, at this exponential phase, with each hop, we're adding about 40% more new cases per day, which means in 2 days, you've doubled the entire previous case count. Welcome to the doubling functions of exponentials. And that's the concern. With every one of those doublings, you just now have more opportunity statistically for one of those embers to escape your quarantine, to jump the border, to get out of control and land there. To me, it's just a matter of time at this point before we see that take hold in another country.
Okay, so we have a disease that is contagious for a full week before the person who is contagious even knows that they're sick. And it's also considerably more contagious than the common cold or a regular seasonal flu. Now, here's where I'm struggling, Chris, to understand what might be coming next. Because with SARS, they could contain the outbreak by scanning people's temperature. You quarantine people who have a fever. It's a pretty clear process there. And that worked so well because people got the fever before they got contagious to other people around them. But that's not true with nCoV. So what I'm struggling with is what should we expect in terms of what the authorities could even do? Obviously, the extreme draconian response would be to shut everything down, declare martial law, and tell everybody in society not to interact with other people unless they're both wearing an N95 rated face mask, which, by the way, I want to ask you more about later on. That would have an insane impact on society. So clearly, you know, that's not practical. What could they do short of that, though, in order to contain this thing when you consider that the people who are transmitting it don't have any symptoms?
Well, I think it's too late to talk about what we could do to stop this thing. That's just, that horse is out of the barn right now. Next, you'd say, okay, given that, I mean, the earliest thing to do would have been to say, wow, they detect this stuff in Wuhan and that's it. Like no flights out, you know, severely limit the traffic and just see if you can contain it there. Very hard to do. You know, the containment numbers have to be nearly perfect, like 99.5%. Like nobody's, you know, walking across the countryside and riding their bicycle through the woods to get away from this thing. You'd have to have nearly perfect containment. And even then, you would have to have the containment in place long enough for this illness to burn entirely through that population and to basically go away. Very, very difficult to do. So now what do you do? And this is where, again, I've been very critical of efforts because the proper way to deal with something like this is you want to immediately get people engaging in proper hygiene, everything the CDC would recommend in their pandemic handbooks, right? You know, you're going to wash your hands, you're going to carry around hand sanitizer, everybody's wearing masks, you're going to have social distancing, like keep at least 6 feet away from people, don't go into places with large crowds, maybe even you shut down schools and other public gathering places like that for a while. And that's not to stop the disease, it's to slow it down, because what you don't want to have happen is for the disease to rampage through your population to the point that it overwhelms your local hospital systems. It's still going to come and it's still going to work its way through. I think that everything we've seen, unless this virus does some magic mutation to suddenly become transmissive but not lethal or problematic, unless we get one of those magic things, this thing is going to burn until we get a vaccine developed, and that's going to take some time.
Okay, Chris. Now, it sounds like no matter what, we're going to get a really big outbreak in the sense of this spreading to a lot of people, and that's people all over the world. It's not going to be contained to China. Flights have been going in and out of China every day, and as of the 30th, the day that we're speaking, they're still sending flights in and out of China every single day. But what the mainstream media and the financial Twitter crowd are all saying is, look, it might be a really big deal and a lot of people are going to get it, but what they're going to get is just a jazzed up flu. It's not like SARS, which had a really high fatality rate of between 9 and 11%, depending on which number or statistic you look at. It's much closer to a seasonal flu. So, okay, maybe a whole bunch of people get sick and miss a few days of work. big deal. In particular, they've pointed out that when you calculate the fatality rate, which is dividing the death toll by the case count, it's only about 2%. Now, frankly, Chris, 2% sounds pretty bad to me, since it's like a tenth of 1% when we're talking about the seasonal flu. But I know you just wrote an article debunking that method of calculation in the members area at peakprosperity.com. So please give us the overview of that article. How should we be thinking about case fatality rate for NCOV if it's not the simple calculation of divide the death toll by the case count, which is what everybody's doing?
Absolutely. And let me start by just framing this, saying there are three big things. Remember, I said we shouldn't all have to become viral epidemiologists, but here we are. Three big things to know about. One is the case fatality rate, and we're just about to discuss that. The second is the R naught. We've discussed that. The third is, what's the serious complication rate? And when you put those three pieces together, that's when you get a full view of any particular virus and any particular pandemic in this case. So let's back up to the case fatality rate. The mistake that's being made all the time is exactly what you said, where the current case count is divided into the known death count. And again, both those numbers might be wrong due to bad reporting for a variety of reasons, some legitimate, some illegitimate. But taking that as it is, let's pretend we had perfect numbers. That's still the wrong way to go about it. And here's why. Each and every day, the people that are being diagnosed with this, that number is growing by 40% a day. So it's growing really, really fast. Second, even if you get diagnosed with this, you don't die like 10 minutes after you get diagnosed. If you're going to die, it takes time for this to develop. So let's say and we don't have the statistics on this yet, so don't hold me to any of this, but let's imagine it's 5 days. Let's imagine from the day you present at the hospital, you're like, geez, I can't breathe. You know, this is getting really bad. And they say, oh yeah, gosh, this is bad. It might take 5 days for somebody who is going to die on average. So therefore, what we can't do is take today's case number and divide it into today's death number. We have to take today's death number and go back 5 days in our case number and divide by that number. And that'll give us a very different case fatality rate. In this case, if we did that with this one, again, full caveat, using the data we've got, the question then is, well, what's the case fatality rate if we do it that way, Chris? And the answer is 11%. Now, and I'm not saying this is right, and I'm not going to sit here and try and defend this, because I don't know if it should be a 5-day lag. I don't know if it should be 7, should be 3. I don't know if I can trust these numbers, but I will tell you that taking today's case number and dividing that into today's death number gives you an inappropriately low number. And here's another thing. Here's an easy prediction. Every day you continue to do that, the case fatality rate is going to look like it's dropping while you're in the exponential phase, because cases are accumulating much, much faster than deaths, because those two lines have very different trajectories under each. They're both exponential, but they have a very different rate underneath it. So when we look at that, this is a mistake that's being made a lot. But I would agree with you, even if we threw all that out the window, 2% is an unacceptably high risk. And as well, we have to understand that's not 2% for everybody. It's really, really heavily clustered in the 50 and older crowd. And paradoxically, it may look like I made a prediction early on the 24th when I was first going out, because it's a flu, it's a coronavirus. So I thought, geez, you know, old people and the very young, infants in particular, you know, usually the people with weakened immune systems, those are going to be most at risk. Actually, we don't have anybody under the age of, I think, 28, 38 was the youngest so far. Don't hold me to that, but I think 38 was the youngest. But really, no kids and no infants. So it honestly looks like, you know, that 2% is a zero if you're, let's say, under the age of 30. But it might be much, much higher than even the 11% I talked about if you're 70, 80, 90, things like that.
Okay, Chris, I want to pick up on what you just said a minute ago. You said it's not just understanding this question of the case fatality rate, but also the serious complication rate. Tell us more about that.
Well, sure. So the flu, the normal flu, has a serious complication rate, by which I mean you required an ICU bed or equivalent at the hospital, right? You needed ventilation, you know, you needed really active support and aggressive medical treatment. So the serious complication rate for flu is typically under 1% in any given season. And for this NCOV, by the numbers, it's around 20%. Now, this all factors in because, as we've seen so far, I don't know, what do we got? Last count, it was like 70 confirmed cases outside of China. And people have been saying, hey, look, no deaths. Well, actually, if the fatality rate was 3% around there, we would have only expected maybe two or three deaths, you know, out of that particular number of people who got infected. So zero, 2 to 3, we're not statistically in the clear yet. But as well, all those people who came out of China who were diagnosed with this, many of them were quite young, you know, below that magic 50-year-old mark, I would say, somewhere in that zone. And all of them got the very, very best medical treatment. And this is where the serious complication rate comes in, because if we simply took the current rate of exponential growth, which is about 40% a day, and we take that with a 20% serious complication rate, and we just go out 30 days from yesterday, we find that at the end of that, there's going to be about 23 million people worldwide with serious complications. 115 million are infected. Again, if we continue the current trajectories, right? So what does that mean? Well, now I think the case fatality rate actually ties into that serious complication rate, because that low case fatality rate that you might experience when people are getting every all hands on deck, they get their own isolation ward, they've got a team of doctors and supportive nurses and assistants, that case fatality rate becomes very different when your hospital system gets overwhelmed, like we saw in the early days of Wuhan's hospitals. By the way, I haven't seen a single image from a hospital in 5 days through the media. So China's got a great firewall clamped down on all of that. But what happens, and this is the reason I get concerned and why I think it's appropriate to have a measured sense of respect for this particular illness, the kind of care you're going to get before your hospital system is overwhelmed is very different from the care you're going to get after it gets overwhelmed, right? And we saw the images from Wuhan, right? There's people in the hallways, they're lying on gurneys in the hallways, you know, they're getting IVs while they're sitting in chairs. That's the kind of care that you end up getting when a system gets overwhelmed. You're not in your own private room with ventilators and 62 machines that go bing, you know, it's a different experience. And so once I think the serious complication rate comes into play and it overwhelms your hospital system, the case fatality rate now is going to spike simply because you can't put enough people, you can't put enough care in for people. So let's imagine, just sake of argument, all 115 million of those cases came to the United States. They'll mostly be in China in this 30-day example. And we had 23 million serious complications. I need to put this in context because the United States has just under 95,000 ICU beds in its complete hospital system. Nearly all of those are already full with the usual car accident victims and people who have other end-of-life issues going on or other complications right now. So it's not like we even have 100,000 beds kicking around. But the question becomes, what kind of medical care are you getting when you have tens of millions of people requiring their serious complications to be dealt with when your system is swamped? And that's why I think, you know, people say, I take a complete opposite view, where the CDC came out recently and said they didn't have any evidence that this was passing asymptomatically. And so therefore they said, you know, until we get that information, we're going to act as if that's true. I would take it completely the opposite. I would say until you have solid evidence that it is not passing asymptomatically, you should pretend as if that is happening. That would be an abundance of caution. So this is where, you know, and I get it from public policy, it's hard to make these sorts of decisions. You know, you're going to shut the economy down. You're going to worry about angry senators and congressmen and people calling you because, you know, you've dinged the precious economy. But in a case like this, with these numbers that we're talking about here, I think an overabundance of caution is the right way to go. And it makes a lot of sense because of what happens when you get to that point of overwhelming your hospital system. And by the way, China doesn't have a third world hospital system. It's actually very good. People get really high quality care there. And we saw in Wuhan, even when they allegedly had less than 50 deaths on the total books, they started building that emergency, you know, 1,000-bed hospital thing that we've all seen, you know, 50, you know, excavators working at once. And they're doing a really amazing job building that. But they wouldn't have been doing that if they didn't have a severe need and a shortage. And this is in a city of 11 million that probably already had, you know, many, many tens of thousands of hospital beds, total hospital beds, and hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of ICU beds. And allegedly, this was all with only 200 people needing it. None of that made sense. So all I can do is trust that the Chinese government is reacting from some data that they haven't shared yet. And it's probably on the high end of anything you and I have talked about so far.
Chris, I just want to let our listeners know that the comments that you've just made almost perfectly mirror the comments that I received from one of our regular listeners who's an ICU nurse in the United States. And she wrote me and she just said, Eric, you know, all the people, they're saying it's crazy to think about this like a 1918 Spanish flu because we have modern medicine. And she's saying, look, I'm modern medicine that they're talking about. And the way it works is we are just incredibly good in the ICU at taking incredibly good care of this tiny, tiny little handful of people, the very small percentage of people that need ICU care in the United States at any moment in time. And she just said, look, we are not equipped. We don't have a system. We don't have a process. We don't have a procedure. We don't know what to do with a pandemic that a whole bunch of people all need ventilators. We've only got so many of them. You don't just order another ventilator on Amazon. You know, it's not the way it works. So these comments, it was actually one of the questions I was going to ask you later on. So I just want to let our listeners know that. But let's move on now, because what you've said is we're talking about a disease which is extremely difficult, if not impossible, to contain because of asymptomatic transmission and the very high contagiousness rate. And so it's, you know, probably more contagious than the flu, maybe more contagious than SARS. And now you're telling us that after adjusting for the effects of exponential growth in the case count, maybe that case fatality rate that a lot of people have been not worried about because it was only 2 or 3%, which frankly I think is worrying by itself, that might actually be more of a SARS-like figure of 9 or 10%. But meanwhile, the mainstream media, everybody on financial Twitter, they're calling me a nutcase and they're telling me not to panic. And quite frankly, to quote Hugh Hendry, I'm kind of starting to think maybe it's time to panic, at least a little bit. This is not my field, though. You're the PhD here. So please tell me if I'm missing anything. I would so love it if you just said, no. Look, you're panicking for no good reason. It's not time to panic. It's not going to be as bad as SARS. It's going to be better in some way. But that's not what I'm hearing here. So help me see what I'm missing, if I'm missing anything.
Well, I've been having this debate, and I've been trying to focus my thinking around it because I get bombarded with that as well, with the people who say, Chris, you're panicking people. That's wrong. And it's usually with a little bit of a paternalistic tone. Oh, not me. Other people, right? So they're fine, but they're worried about other people, right? And I happen to have a lot more faith in my fellow humans. I believe that if given the full complement of information, almost everybody will do the right thing with that. A few may be unable to really process that. But I'm really operating from a place of, listen, give people the appropriate information. They can make appropriate decisions. And so I'm not advocating panicking, because that would imply making bad decisions and doing things that are more harmful than not. So here's what I've been trying to do to sharpen this up. Let's imagine for the moment that you said, listen, don't spread any fear around this. I'm like, okay, well, are facts, can I spread facts about this stuff? Because that's all I've been doing. I'm like, here's the facts, you know, and when they change, I'll change my view on this. But as the facts stand right now, no, you're not being alarmist. And so here's how I've broken this down in my head. Let's imagine we said, okay, let's not give any caution to the public because can't trust them, right? All right. So in a no fear case, people don't know what the risk is. So they don't change any behaviors, right? They walk around, you know, they're coughing, they sneeze without covering up. They shake hands, they touch their faces. Maybe they eat, you know, before washing their hands. They still congregate. They're not using proper hygiene. Tens of millions under this scenario get infected. Hundreds of thousands develop severe complications. Tens of thousands die unnecessarily because the hospital system got overwhelmed because people just let this disease rampage through their population. So let's go with the fear. What is fear? Now, it's not fear. It's just caution. It's just prudence to me. So what happens if people are prudent about all this? They take the data and they go, huh? Well, okay. Maybe they're a little fearful because this is virus particles and we can't see them. So that makes us a little unnerved. But because they can't see this and there's those unknowns, they develop an overabundance of caution. They socially shame people who cough and sneeze without wearing face masks. They don't shake and touch hands or escalator railings, doorknobs, or any of that stuff without immediately using hand sanitizer that they now carry with them everywhere. They forgo large gatherings, places where congregation might unnecessarily expose them to higher odds of being near an infected person, symptomatic or otherwise. And because of that, there's a vastly slower progression of this disease through the population The contagion, therefore, doesn't swamp the hospital system, like your reader was talking about, that nurse saying, you know, there's only so many resources to treat the severely ill. And because of that, because this contagion doesn't swamp the hospital system, many more people live. So this is where I'm really at odds with the people who say, don't spread fear, because I'm not spreading fear. I'm spreading information. And I'm saying, if we treat this with appropriate prudence and respect, we have a chance of managing it. But if we just keep people ignorant, that's where the trouble actually lies. And this isn't equivalent to saying, you know, oh, I did this in philosophy class and we learned that yelling fire in a crowded movie theater is a bad thing, right? This isn't a crowded movie theater, right? This is a very different situation. This is contagion. You want people's behaviors to change, and that's really hard to do from a public policy standpoint. Look, FEMA is out there in California every year reminding people they live on active fault zones. And people see the destruction every so often. And with all of that, with all that pushing, about 3% of the population of California has a 48-hour emergency kit in their closet. It's very hard to get people to change behavior. So I think this is an important conversation, debate to have, but it's not binary. It's either not, it's not fear, no fear. The question is, what's the right amount of emotional connection you want people to have so that they pay attention and actually change their behaviors? Because information alone never changes behaviors. And that's the critical mistake that the no fear crowd is making. They're thinking, oh, when it gets bad, we'll just give people information, they'll change. That never works. Not in the real world. Doesn't work that way.
Okay, Chris, but we're both telling a pretty grim story here. So in the interest of responsible journalism, I want to intentionally take the other side of this argument. You have admitted that we don't know what the R-naught value is. What we're doing is we're using the exponential growth rate of the case count as a proxy to tell us that it looks like that R-naught could be a pretty high number. The thing is, the really scary scenarios that you and I are both looking at is if that case count were to continue to grow exponentially as it has been on that same trajectory for the next 2 months, we'd be looking at hundreds of millions of people being infected. But you said yourself, there's an exponential phase. So is there an argument that says, okay, look, you go through a phase that we're going through right now where there's an exponential growth of the case count, but that peters off. And then all of a sudden, you know, you get to a much slower growth and it's not so bad. And you know, I'm not the PhD here. What other arguments are there that we should at least be, you know, giving some airtime to that make the opposite case, that maybe this is not as bad as you and I both fear it could be?
Well, the strongest argument I have right now is maybe all the data we have is just complete junk, you know, that China is feeding us really bad information, and even they don't know because their systems aren't good enough to track things appropriately. So that would be my biggest hope in all of this is that China has bad information. So do we. And by the way, I'm really encouraged by the fact that we haven't seen a lot of spreading yet across the other parts of the world. A few cases here and there, but almost all of those, Eric, are from people who just got off a plane from China. So that's really actually pretty good news. And I don't have a great explanation for that yet. So I kind of think that data is at odds with the China data right now. And I think the next few weeks will tell us a lot. Second, if you do look at something like SARS, the reason that one levels off, you know, it didn't really have a true exponential explosion phase, and then it did level off is because of everything you mentioned, which is that this was something that you could actually chase down and prevent because once somebody presented, that's when they became infective. So there was a little tiny window between when they might have been infective and when they got detected. And because of that, there were relatively few contacts that they had made socially, and you could hunt all of those down. The worry in this case is that, of course, if it is transmitting during an asymptomatic phase, like back to that Japanese bus driver, we don't know how many people got on his bus and how many people they then contacted. And, you know, also that 5-day incubation period, which could be 7, could be 2, we're not really clear, but kind of looks like it's centering around 5. But again, data could change. That means that there's plenty of time to make lots and lots of contacts. So that's my hope at this point, to take the other side of this is to say, well, maybe China's got it wrong. We haven't seen a real explosion in cases yet outside of China. So those two pieces together feel pretty good. And so I'm pretty hopeful around that. But I don't have the hope that we're going to be able to contain this by tracking down all of the possible exposed people because, you know, what do you do? You know, somebody, oh, there was an infected person on that plane flight. There were 238 other people on that plane and they walked through a terminal. I mean, you're done, right? There's no good way to track all of that down. So, you know, that's where we're just going to have to watch this. And I would also remind people, this is going to go through phases and waves. The Spanish flu was three main waves. The first one was bad, but not that bad compared to the second wave that came around 6 to 8 months later. That one was really bad. And then the third wave was pretty bad too. And these things tend to go in waves because, again, we're starting from a population of about 7.8 billion with 0% immunity. Well, maybe there's a few naturally immune people out there for reasons we don't know yet, but I mean, essentially, effectively zero. So it's going to take a while for A, the herd immunity to build up. These are people who get it and survive. And by the way, most people do, right? So the herd immunity will build up. And the other thing we're going to have to watch out for is the mutations that are going to be happening. This is an RNA virus. They mutate very, very rapidly. I was reading about one cluster case of a family in China where they did RNA typing on all of these viruses and said, you know, where did they get this? Because they were expecting them all to come from within that family. And they did. There was a person who brought it there, but every single member had basically their own brand of a coronavirus in them when they tested it. So it mutates very rapidly. The hope is that it mutates in a positive direction. The fear is it mutates in a negative direction. But let's be clear, the one mutation that gets selected for always in a virus is the one that makes it transmit farther and faster. The hope is that you get that mutation plus a mutation that makes it less lethal for some reason. And again, too early, we don't know really what's going on with this yet. So the other thing I would caution people around is all of this information may well be very different by later today, tomorrow, next week. And it's being gathered fast and furious, and it's going to sharpen and crisp up over time.
I haven't mentioned yet, and I probably should have, that we are recording this on the morning of the 30th before the WHO press conference, where they may declare an international emergency at the press conference later today. They've not done so as of the time of this recording. So clearly, Chris, the important part of this story is its humanitarian impact, the implications socially, what people can do to protect themselves and their families from infection and so forth. The thing is, though, this is Macro Voices. This is an investment website. You already have a terrific website at peakprosperity.com where you're covering all of those aspects of the outbreak. Our job here is to translate world events, even bad ones, into their economic and market implications. So I'd like to tap your financial brain now and talk about what this is going to mean for the economy and financial markets. And let's start with the economy. You know, SARS had very significant impacts in Hong Kong, where it was centered. But really, in terms of global GDP, SARS was basically a non-event. It freaked a few people out. It blew over. It was forgotten about from an economic perspective, although it had horrific humanitarian implications. How do you see this ENCOV thing playing out based on what we see so far?
Well, this actually has me very worried, economically speaking. And I'm especially worried for my fellow United States citizens, everybody everywhere, but in this country, and I think Canada too, Australia, we're just loaded to our eyeballs in average or median household debt. The amount of savings people have is not high. And when you get something like this coming through, what people need to be prepared for is the idea that schools may close for weeks, which they already have in Hong Kong. And if it gets bad enough, your whole city may shut down for a period of time, which we're seeing in Beijing, Shanghai, Wuhan. They look like ghost cities. It's shocking in a way that's hard to convey, seeing these 8 lanes in each direction, 16 lane wide boulevards that you could walk across without looking in either direction and be totally safe because there's nothing happening. No cars, no trucks, no buses, it's just everything's sort of shut down. And that's, to me, is the equivalent of riding your bicycle and shoving a fat stick through the spokes on your front wheel. It's really, it's never the fall that hurts you. It's how fast you stop. So this is a really, really sudden breaking of the world economy. And as I'm sure your listeners are more aware than most, this is at a time of record high indebtedness and a lot of fancy shenanigans in the financial system and financialization, all of which is kind of dependent on everything continuing to work just right. So So there's just that raw shock value, which just, you know, is something that can be very hard for financial markets to absorb and digest. It's a tough thing in a world where 16% or whatever the number is now by the BIS of companies are zombie companies and things like that, where you kind of need everything kind of to cook along. You need your financial markets really operating well to keep zombie companies going. And then on the logistics and operations side, we don't know what this means, right? So Shanghai and Suzhou, right next door, which is a major manufacturing center, are both effectively shut down. And hey, they were closed for the Chinese New Year, but they're not going to be reopening for sure until February 8th at the earliest, according to the official dictates. And that could change. Could be later, maybe earlier, but probably later. So what does it mean? And we can't really analyze that yet. The global supply impacts are going to be just impossible to parse through. And we're going to have to do it on a case-by-case basis, but we could do worse than to back up, look at the London Metal Exchange, and just see it cratering. And looking at the price of copper, cratering. You know, even as the stock price of Tesla vaults up, you know, that's a story stock. I'm tracking very carefully two things. One, the base inputs. So this is going to be things like oil, coal, steel prices, copper, all those base inputs. And then as well, I'm looking at the edge of things. I'm looking at the CCC credit that's sitting out there. You know, look at your HYG, your JNK as proxies, but also if you can get your hands on actual CCC credit spreads, things always start from the outside in. And I'm worried that this is a financial shock that qualifies as the proverbial black swan. Nobody expected it and nobody knows quite how to process it. And events are moving faster than people's ability to process them. And so that shock value, I think, is the thing that worries me the most about such an over-leveraged system is the one, thank you, Federal Reserve and other central banks, the one that we've been granted in all of this. Because again, this sudden stopping or cessation, that's going to be the thing that's going to really jar the system. And we're just going to have to watch and see what happens. But the risks are very elevated right now.
Chris, let's touch on gold briefly. When bad things happen in the world, gold usually goes up. Now, there's one theory I've seen written about on the internet, which is that Lunar New Year, the big Chinese holiday, which has basically been canceled, is a major gold gifting and buying period in a lot of Asia. So some people thought that this was going to be a big down event for gold prices. So far, that's not what the chart's showing me. What's your outtake on what this means for precious metals?
Well, gold does really well in times of uncertainty. I have less analysis of it in terms of stocks and flows and all of that because, you know, there's quite a lot of gold floating around there. And really, the question is, why would people want to hold it? And for me, you know, and again, I don't ascribe anything to this idea that you want to hold gold because it's an inflation hedge. The data just doesn't stack up well there. But what it does stack up perfectly for, and I think I can make a logical argument for, is it does really well in times of financial uncertainty, especially if you think there's counterparty risk involved. It's a tier one asset. It not only behaves like money, but it has a quality that most money doesn't have, which is that when you own it, it's nobody else's liability. It's just an asset that you've got. It's got a very special sort of a role to play, particularly during periods like we had in 2008 when nobody knew who to trust and Lehman Brothers is going down. Oops, there goes Bear Stearns. And when people didn't have a lot of faith or trust, that's when, you know, gold has a very important role to play. And secondarily, we've been seeing a lot of people taking that sort of position anyway, all across Europe, a lot of central banks even getting back in on the buying game. And I think a lot of that is because gold is something you can be at least certain of to some degree during very uncertain times. And my concern and the reason I hold gold through all of this is, you know, I don't like the central banks printing and I'm convinced that Jay Powell, you know, is going to print more and so will the ECB. They'll do all of that. But what they can't do is they can't print their way out of collapsing Chinese oil demand. You can't print your way out of collapsing demand for copper. You can't print your way out of the fact that if a company is fundamentally unprofitable at its core, it's never going to be a profitable company. And we got a lot of zombies out there. And we got a lot of unicorns that are making, you know, negative cash flows. And we got a whole shale industry that's still burning negative cash flows. So it's those are things that you can't really fix with monetary policy. And the concern, the reason I'm a fan of gold in this environment, and I won't be forever, but I am right now, is because I think that the central banks are going to continue to print until something just breaks. And when it breaks, the amount of uncertainty in the financial system is going to be large enough that nobody's going to want counterparty risks. Everybody's going to be scrambling for non-counterparty assets. And there aren't that many of them. Gold is a tiny market compared to, well, even Norway's sovereign wealth fund, just to name one thing. So that's really where I think gold is going to do well, as it were. And I wish it wasn't going to do well for those reasons, but here we are. Nothing I can do about 10 years of really bad central bank policy.
Chris, I wish we could go on, but we're way past out of time. Before I let you go, we didn't even get to N95 masks and the various precautions that people can take. You cover a lot of that at peakprosperity.com. So very briefly, what is peakprosperity.com? What can our listeners expect to find on your website?
Well, it's a wonderful community of people. This is where I post all my content, of course. It's about 90% free. We have a place for subscribers as well, mostly people who want to go deeper and have some of those offline conversations that aren't appropriate to have in public. And my role in the world, I call myself an information scout, and I just do my best to take fast-moving, complicated situations like this one, simple, and as well to analyze through the big, big, big trends like you. And I'm also looking at the economy, as well as energy, as well as the environment. I think we have to look at all three together. To me, those come up with a collective, uh-oh, and what do I do about that? And then most of the work after the problem definition is done is around how do you prosper in this environment? What kind of changes can you make in your life? Should you make across all sorts of dimensions, including your health, the food you eat and where it's grown, your emotional health and capital, as well as your social capital. So we touch a lot of dimensions because we see a world that's changing, and our listeners and subscribers want to be in front of those changes.
Chris, in closing, I sincerely hope that you and I are both completely wrong in the concerns and fears that we have. But frankly, I would rather err on the side of caution than complacency. And I think a lot of people are erring in the direction of complacency right now. So I hope that people will ridicule us for being all wrong about this, but I'm afraid that might not be the case. Again, listeners, the interview you just heard was recorded on January 30th. The remainder of this podcast was recorded on March 2nd, 2020. I'll now give you an update on what's changed since January. Exactly as Dr. Martinson predicted, COVID-19 has gone global. The good news is that the 40% per day exponential case count growth that we were seeing in China at the time of that interview has slowed down considerably, and we don't yet have the millions of cases, as Dr. Martinson said, were possible in coming weeks. But for several reasons, I don't think it would be prudent to rule out that kind of case growth in the near future. At this point, what is actually being detected are the major outbreak areas where lots of people are becoming extremely ill and many have died. At the moment, Daegu, South Korea, Northern Ireland, and Iran are the hardest hit areas. France and Germany have also been seeing significant case growth in recent days. But the single most important point that I want to make in this entire podcast is that so far, all that's being detected are the cases in areas where the problem is severe enough to cause crises, as is the case in Iran, Korea, and Italy. You may have heard President Trump emphasize that there were only a couple of dozen cases in the United States and that those people are, for the most part, getting better. The general tone of his message was to reassure Americans that we don't really have a problem in the United States. Well, first of all, the official case count is now up to 88 in the United States as of March 2nd. But more to the point, I'm personally convinced that it's just the tip of the iceberg and that there will soon be thousands more. The key to this is asymptomatic transmission and the long incubation period. And by the way, since the interview with Dr. Martinson was recorded, new evidence has shown the incubation period can be even longer than we thought, up to 28 days in some cases. But here's the point I really want you to ponder. The small nation of South Korea has already conducted more than 80,000 PCR tests for COVID-19 to date. As of March 2nd, the Centers for Disease Control website indicates the total number of tests completed in the United States is 472. Not 472,000, just 472 tests total. Less than 500 PCR tests have been completed to date by the CDC, the public health authority for the richest and most powerful nation in the world. Meanwhile, the much smaller nation of South Korea has tested more than 80,000 of its citizens. State and local laboratories are starting to gear up on their own, I would say in part because the CDC has been very slow to step up to its public responsibility. So we now have some states and localities developing the ability to do their own testing. But so far, the CDC has only conducted 472 tests, according to their website. You can't detect what you don't test. And it's a simple matter of fact that we're not yet doing any meaningful community surveillance testing in the United States. So it's entirely possible that millions of Americans are already infected and simply don't realize it, because for most people, the symptoms are very mild for the first few weeks after infection. The only way to really know how widely community transmission is occurring is if you conduct community surveillance testing. Now, to be sure, the CDC has announced its intention to do exactly that. They plan to begin surveillance testing in 5 major U.S. cities. Negative seasonal flu tests will be tested for COVID-19. But those plans are still on the drawing board, and widespread surveillance testing has yet to begin in the United States as of March 2nd. But hold on. The story doesn't end there. CDC's official policy states that the only people to be tested now, before the surveillance testing program is launched, are people who have either traveled recently to China or have been directly exposed to a person who has been confirmed as infected with COVID-19. There have been several instances where Americans who are presenting symptoms consistent with COVID-19 have asked to be tested and have been refused because they didn't meet the criteria of recent travel to China. In at least one case that I'm aware of, a person returning from northern Italy, one of the biggest current breakout zones, was refused a COVID-19 test because they hadn't been to China. Dr. Ben Hunt, at Epsilon Theory on Twitter, coined the hashtag "Don't Test, Don't Tell" to describe this phenomenon, and he's written quite a bit about the shortcomings of U.S. community testing being slow in coming. My point is simply to impress upon you that the statistic that there are only a very, very small number of cases in the United States is misleading. First of all, the official figure has quadrupled in just a few days since President Trump made that statement. And more importantly, we just plain don't know how much community transmission is occurring because we're not testing for it yet. Washington State has been taking the matter into their own hands, and a report released just in the last 24 hours concludes that there may already be hundreds of Americans infected with COVID-19 in just the Pacific Northwest region alone. On the subject of R0, the transmissivity index, Dr. Martinson described some figures for R0 of 2.0, and then he went on to describe how much more severe it is if R0 turned out to be 2.5. And then at the end of that discussion, he alluded to the possibility that if it were to turn out that R0 was actually as high as 3.0, well, boy, then we'd really be in trouble. Two very important studies have been released that conclude R0 for COVID-19 may actually be much higher than first thought. The first was published by the Chinese National Academy of Sciences on January 29th, one day before my interview with Dr. Martinson. But we were not yet aware of that study when the interview that you just heard was taped. It concluded that R0 could be as high as 4.08 for COVID-19. That's beyond anything Dr. Martinson imagined when that interview was taped. Then, more than a week after the interview was recorded, the prestigious Los Alamos National Laboratory in the United States published a paper concluding that R0 for COVID-19 was much higher than previously believed. They stated a range between 4.7 and 6.6. Remember, this is an exponential relationship. So 4.7 to 6.6 is many, 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 many times more possible infections. It's not additive. It's an exponential relationship. These numbers are the base of an exponent. They went on to describe a case doubling time of potentially being as short as just 2.4 days. And the very rapid case growth that we saw in Daegu, South Korea, appears to confirm the study's conclusion of an extremely high R0 and extremely short case doubling times. What was even more alarming about that study was its conclusion that even with the imposition of draconian containment measures used in China, where entire cities were put on lockdown and residents were forbidden from leaving their homes, even then, R-naught was estimated to be mitigated down only to a level of about 2.5. Now, that's still the level that Dr. Martinson was talking about in this interview as an incredibly dangerous pandemic level of transmissivity. In the interview, at one point, Dr. Martinson alluded to the point that so far, there was evidence only of droplet transmission, meaning that you can catch COVID-19 from someone coughing or sneezing in your immediate proximity. But there was no evidence of aerosol transmission, meaning the disease could be transmitted through air conditioning ducts and carried through different parts of a building and so forth. Since that interview, evidence of aerosol transmission has been presented by the scientific community. The studies have yet to be peer-reviewed, and to some extent, the scientific jury is still out on aerosol transmission. But the preponderance of evidence suggests that it's happening. This means that cruise ships, public transportation, and any place where there's a large gathering of people, such as sporting events or business conferences, could be hotspots for massive infection incidents. Initial signs suggest that much of the Daegu, South Korea outbreak was caused by just one so-called super spreader attending a church service in close proximity to hundreds of other worshippers. More than half of the people present at that church service have since tested positive for COVID-19. One report, not yet peer-reviewed, has suggested the possibility that a second reinfection of COVID-19 could be much deadlier than the first infection. Now, I want to stress that the science on this one is limited to just one report, and it could be wrong. But if correct, the implications could be staggering. The hypothesis, again, not yet proven, is that on the second reinfection with this virus in the same patient, some patients will experience something called a cytokine storm. The medical science is way beyond my pay grade. A simple layperson's explanation is that on that second infection, some patients' immune systems basically malfunction in a way that causes the patient to die from their own immune system attacking their organs much faster than the virus itself ever could. It has been suggested that this phenomenon could explain the videos that we've seen, first from China and now from South Korea, showing people who were seemingly just walking down the street, going about their business, and all of a sudden, wham, they fall dead in their tracks, with zero warning of their impending fate. Again, the jury on this one isn't just still out, it's actually just convening. So it's too early to know whether that hypothesis has any merit. But if proven true, the implications are staggering. If people fear sudden instantaneous death from getting a second infection of this disease, obviously it's going to cause a very, very different level of public reaction. Dr. Martinson was attacked by the social media police for his views expressed in the interview that you just heard. In early February, those views were considered lunatic fringe. Everyone else was saying, hey, it's just the flu and nothing to worry about. Dr. Martinson's YouTube channel was demonetized, meaning that he no longer has a source of revenue to fund the production costs for his daily COVID-19 videos on the Peak Prosperity YouTube channel. Watching those daily videos has become a part of my daily routine, and I strongly recommend them to interested listeners. Again, just go to YouTube, type in Peak Prosperity, and you'll find his daily update videos. As I record this podcast on the morning of March 2nd, central banks around the globe have come riding in like the cavalry to rescue financial markets. Announcements of forthcoming stimulus from the Bank of Japan, Royal Bank of Australia, and hints from the U.S. Federal Reserve that monetary policy action is imminent have all collectively resulted in a pop in both stock and commodity markets. But I don't expect it to last long. Unlike the 2008 crisis, which was all about the financial system itself breaking down, central banks cannot cure a pandemic virus for which no vaccine is even expected for a year. We live in an era when market participants have become conditioned to believe that central bank liquidity cures all ills. It even appears that Christine Lagarde actually believes that solving climate change is part of the ECB's charter. So I expect central bank accommodation to have a definitive upside effect on all asset markets, but only a temporary one. Most people in mainstream society are still on the fence as to whether this is just a bad flu, or maybe it's a little worse than that. The facts and evidence suggest that what's really going on is that a global pandemic has been in full swing for over a month now. But due to long incubation periods and asymptomatic transmission and practically non-existent community testing, we've yet to detect what is actually already occurring and has been for more than a month. Rather than focusing on timely commencement of widespread community testing to monitor the pandemic's progress, public resources have instead been focused on reassuring the public and financial markets that there's nothing to worry about. It's all under control. We've chosen to wait until situations like those in Daegu, South Korea, northern Italy, and Iran explode to the point where they can no longer be ignored. Rather than deploying all possible resources to detect the next outbreak before it can even get started, public officials seem to be more concerned with keeping the economy and financial markets running and avoiding a panic during an election year. I sincerely hope to be proven wrong, but my base case expectation is that we will see many more outbreaks around the globe of a similar nature to what has already been seen in Italy, Iran, and South Korea, and that includes outbreaks of similar magnitude inside the United States. Financial markets have finally woken up to what should have been obvious a full month earlier, that we have a serious problem. But I don't believe that they've even begun to fully discount the full extent of that problem. My advice to investment professionals is to stop worrying about whether this is another SARS or another MERS and start thinking about whether this will ultimately result in a bigger or a smaller economic dislocation than the 2008 Great Financial Crisis. I can argue both sides of that question, and it's obviously way too early to know the real answer for sure. A lot of it depends on how the pandemic goes and whether or not we're able to contain this the way some countries like Singapore and Hong Kong seem to have been able to get their outbreaks under control, or if more outbreaks are going to go the way of South Korea, Iran, and Italy. My point is simply that it's time to stop pretending that this is just the flu and that it's going to go away soon. We have a global pandemic, and it's a pandemic that is still in its early days. And I fear the worst is yet to come. Again, I sincerely hope to be proven wrong. On February 24th, I recorded another podcast with a rockstar panel of the most prolific voices on financial Twitter relative to COVID-19. The panel includes a return by Dr. Chris Martinson, Jim Bianco from Bianco Research, who was on top of this story even before I was, Dr. Ben Hunt, author of the Epsilon Theory blog, and Mike Shedlock. That podcast was titled Hot Topic Number 5, and it can be found free of charge on our homepage at macrovoices.com. It contains more recent information than today's interview with Dr. Chris Martinson, so I strongly encourage you to listen to it if you haven't already. Before closing, I'd like to mention that I've been inundated with emails from people accusing me of being a fearmonger, of inciting panic, and generally being a bad person for being so outspoken about this pandemic. In particular, I've received quite a few comments telling me that it is irresponsible and unprofessional to speculate about such matters, and that I'm a bad, bad person for doing so. Look, people, I certainly agree that it would be reckless and irresponsible for public health officials or school principals to speculate about things that they don't know for certain. But as a trader in financial markets, speculation is my full-time job. This is not a public health channel, nor is it a government news service. You chose of your own volition to tune into a podcast produced by a professional speculator in commodity futures markets. If you find it offensive that I speculate based on partial and incomplete information about what factors could determine the future direction of financial markets, then I submit to you that it is you, not I, who are suffering from a cognitive disorder. Simply put, if you find speculation offensive, please don't tune in to podcasts produced by professional speculators. Grown-ups shouldn't need this explained to them, but it seems that some listeners do. And frankly, I'm really getting sick of the whining emails calling me a fearmonger. The actual fact of the matter is that I was on top of this story a full month before almost everyone else, and my listeners have made a ton of money from the insights that I've shared with them. I make no apologies to those of you who think it's wrong of me to speculate about things that I'm not certain of. I really wish you would stop emailing me because I'm ignoring your emails. I delete them without reading them. Please don't waste your time. Thank you. For the Macro Voices Podcast Network, I'm Eric Townsend.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.